Thank you, Blessing Zulu and Jonga Kandemiri. Good evening, Zimbabwe. You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America on Thursday, March 27th, 2014. Thank you for joining us live from Washington. This is Sandra Nyaira. Studio 7 is going out to Zimbabwe on 909 medium wave and on 4930, 5940 and 15455 shortwave frequencies. On the internet, find us at www.studio7news.com or text us at 001-202-465-0318. Here are our top stories this evening. The EU-Africa summit, which is set for Brussels next week, is hanging in the balance as the diplomatic rift between the two groups continues to widen over participants. The government assists Tokyo Mkhosi flood victims with clothing and food items as affected families continue to live in squalid conditions months after the disaster.
And the number of Zimbabweans dying from AIDS-related illnesses continues to decline.
The European Union and Africa summit, which is set for Brussels next week, is hanging in the balance as the diplomatic rift between the two groups continues to widen. The African Union's Peace and Security Council has advised the bloc not to attend the summit set for Brussels from April 2 to April 3 to protest the way Europe is allegedly holding the continent in court contempt by determining who is eligible to attend the meeting. African nations have expressed serious concern over the non-invitation of Sudan, Eritrea, and the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, and the EU's refusal to grant a visa to Zimbabwe's First Lady, Grace Mugabe, who is on the EU sanctions list. The African Union is also bitter that an invitation was extended to Egypt, which is suspended by the continental bloc after an alleged military coup ended the reign of elected President Mohamed Morsi. Foreign Affairs Permanent Secretary Joy Bima tells Studio 7's Blessing Zulu that Africa is united in its demands.
The Permanent Representatives Committee met in Addis Ababa yesterday to consider the response by the EU to the concerns that they had put before the EU itself. These mainly had to do with, one, the non-invitation of countries like Sudan and the Sahrawi, the invitation of Egypt, which was under EU sanctions, the invitation of Morocco, which was not part of the African Union, and also the denial of a visa to the First Lady of Zimbabwe. The EU response had not made any movement on these issues, and so the PRC recalled the decision that had been made by the heads of state and government in January in their summit. In terms of issues that they had to agree with the European Union for them to participate in the summit, and in particular the invitation of all leaders to the summit itself. So in the light of those developments, they have recommended that the summit be postponed. This is something that has been recommended to the chair of the African Union, Mauritania. And then it is now up to the leader of Mauritania to consult with his colleagues within the African Union to see what is the way forward in light of the recommendations of the PRC.
What reason was given by the EU to deny the First Lady a visa?
They were very evasive. They said Zimbabwe has submitted a delegation list of about 70 people, and the EU is in the process of assessing and issuing them. But that is not true, because they've actually informed us formally that the First Lady has not been issued a visa.
Of Foreign Affairs Permanent Secretary Joy Bima in Harare. Blessing also reached European Union Head of Delegation to Zimbabwe, Ambassador Aldo Deraricia, who insists the First Lady's situation is complicated since she is on the EU's sanctions list, adding the regional bloc is still waiting for a formal communication from Africa.
We were informed that the Peace and Security Council has made a recommendation to postpone the event if the issue of the invitation situation is not solved. But there is a proper procedure internal to the African Union, so these are to be presented to the chair of the European Union, which is Mauritania, and then it has to be communicated to all the member states of the African Union, then they have to decide how to proceed from there.
How about the visa for the First Lady of Zimbabwe, Grace Mugabe?
You see, the point is that this fourth EU-Africa summit is a working summit. But it is what you could call a stag meeting, which means a meeting without spouses. It was clarified in all the papers on the preparation event that there would be no spouses, no program for the spouses, which is an elegant way of saying that the spouses were not invited. And so because the spouses were not invited, the host country, which is Belgium, in order to issue the visa to the spouse of the president, had to go through the normal procedure, which is adopted when a person who is on the list of restrictive measures applies for a visa to go to the European Union. So this procedure could be waived for the president because he was invited, but the First Lady was not invited, and therefore Belgium had to follow that procedure. And this is a procedure where you have to have the unanimity of all the member states, all the 28 member states of the European Union, to be able to waive the restriction. And this was not possible.
European Union Head of Delegation to Zimbabwe, Ambassador Aldo Deraricha, speaking with Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Harare.
Political analyst Joy Mabenge, acting director of the Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition, tells Blessing that Africa stands to lose more by boycotting the summit.
I think these are matters that should not really have crept in terms of ensuring that this meeting goes on. But also to come back and say they are threatening to boycott because Zimbabwe's First Lady also was denied a visa or was not invited to this summit, which is a summit that is supposed to be attended by heads of state. I mean, really, there is a background to this, and the background is that, with all due respect, my Grace Mugabe still remains on the sanctions list from the EU and President Mugabe. So to extend the invitation that has been extended to the president, who is the head of state and government, to his spouse, I think really there will be an anomaly there. But that cannot be a big issue that would lead us to say that Zimbabwe must not attend the summit on the basis that the First Lady is not invited. There is good rule in having the president attending.
Who is the biggest loser in all this?
I mean, really, you would agree with me that, well, I mean, the desired situation is that there must be equal partnership between the players involved. There must be equal partnership between Africa and the EU. But of course, really, in terms of who often requires much help from the other, of course, we know that Africa requires much help from the EU.
A political analyst Joy Mabenge, acting director of the Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition, on the line from Harare with Studio 7's Blessing Zulu from Harare. The EU-Africa summit has been drama-filled for several years now. In 2007, then-British Prime Minister Gordon Brown boycotted the Lisbon summit, protesting Mr. Mugabe's presence, accusing the Zimbabwean leader of violating people's rights. Plans for the Lisbon summit had been put on hold since 2003 as the EU and Africa wrangled over Mr. Mugabe's attendance. The first AU-EU summit was in Cairo in 2000, followed by Lisbon and Tripoli in 2010.
The government today assisted Tokwe Mkhosi flood victims with clothing and food items as affected families continue to live in squalid conditions after the disaster. Thomas Chiripasi has more details from Harare.
At the handover ceremony of the goods in the capital today, Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa said government decided to donate food and clothing confiscated by the Zimbabwe Revenue Authority from citizens who were trying to evade import duty. He said some of the goods were forfeited to the state after importers failed to raise import duty. Instead of keeping the goods at Zimra warehouses, the finance minister said the government decided the goods would make a difference in the lives of the affected Tokwe Mkhosi flood victims.
So these are the goods that we have identified in our warehouses and have taken a decision that they be donated to the victims of the Tokwe Mkhosi floods. So we are working in conjunction with ZIMRA, and in fact these goods are under charge of ZIMRA, and they are in their warehouses across the country, which are ZIMRA warehouses. So they've been identified, and the goods include, which we are symbolically handing over to Comrade Basket, footwear, 23,552 pairs. Clothing, 2,535 kg. Blankets, 1,421 units. Clothing, we also have clothing in 379 packages. Footwear, 570 boxes. Clothing, 467 bales, and blankets, 31 bales. We have also identified cooking oil and soap which were seized and forfeited to the state, and this will also be handed over to Comrade Basket in the forthcoming week.
Mwenezi legislator Kudakwashe Basket, who received the goods on behalf of the affected families, welcomed the donation, saying it will go a long way in uplifting the lives and spirits of the flood victims.
So this is a most welcome donation. It will go a long way in supporting and easing up the challenges and pains the people are going through at the moment.
Basket, who also sits in a committee set up by the government to mobilize assistance for the flood victims, said the donation will reach the intended beneficiaries, adding a proper inventory would be compiled.
We have a team of auditors at the provincial level of the Civil Protection Unit, and we activated again another team on site at the district level where goods are stored, and we always account for the distribution of these goods. And it is my assurance that these goods will go a long way, and we always account for them in a transparent manner. When we receive goods, always, not only these ones, but even those we received before and we continue to receive, we issue out invoices showing the inventory and the number of goods we have received.
Reports say several children affected by the floods are not going to school, either because the makeshift schools set up by the government are too far for them to attend, or because they are not feeling well due to an outbreak of waterborne diseases. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Green Fuels, a company with links to controversial businessman Billy Rottenbach, today said the government, which wants a 51% stake in the fuel blending company, should pay for the shares at market value to avoid prejudicing investors. Ivan Chifera has details from Harare.
Green Fuel is a joint venture company between the state-controlled Agricultural Rural Development Authority, ADA, and companies linked to Rottenberg, Magdom Investments and Rating Investments. It was controversially issued an ethanol production or mandatory blending license last August, despite massive disagreements in the unity government cabinet and the ZANPF government following the 2013 elections. Opponents argued the company's licensing would result in an individual benefiting at the expense of the nation. ADA has 10% shares in the company, and now the government has indicated it wants to acquire a 51% stake in the firm. But Parliament heard from Green Fuels officials today, who told the Indigenization Committee that they are ready to comply with the government's directive to convert the project from a build, operate and transfer system to a joint venture, with the government having the majority shareholding. Green Fuels General Manager Graham Smith told the committee government must pay to acquire the majority shares in the firm.
Magdom and Green Fuel agreed into a joint venture with the government of Zimbabwe on commercial terms so as not to prejudice the shareholders or place the financiers at risk. This commitment has been communicated to the government through the Ministry of Agriculture, Mechanization and Irrigation Development. In line with such directive, Green Fuel, Magdom and ADA whom represent the government of Zimbabwe, into a joint venture based upon the initial commercial value of the contributions brought to the project to date.
Mark Dom, he said, has since invested more than $330 million in the firm, representing a 90% stake in the project, while government has put in $37 million, an equivalent of 10%. Green Fuel legal advisor Derek Elliott explains they are negotiating with the Agriculture, Energy and Indigenization Ministries to implement the government directive.
These negotiations are currently in process and underway. That is not detracting from the fact that the companies in question are indigenous, indigenously owned. The transaction per se, which you are relating to, is essentially what we are working towards, a government acquiring 51%.
The officials refuted reports that they owe the Zimbabwe National Water Authority $7 million, saying it was Zinwa, which owes the company slightly more than $1 million.
We dispute this, and based on our reconciliations, have ascertained that Zinwa in fact owes the estate $1.26 million due to the fact that they have been overcharging for water actually used. In addition, we have rehabilitated and continue to maintain the Middle Sabi pump house at Zinwa's cost. We pay electricity and other service charges for which Zinwa would ordinarily be liable.
They said the company had also carried out and submitted its environmental impact assessment report to the Environmental Management Agency, but it is yet to get a response. The law stipulates that in the event that the EMA does not respond in 60 months, the report would be deemed approved. The officials said their company had faced stiff resistance from foreign and local oil companies who fear mandatory blending, saying this would eat into their profits. The situation, they said, is however under control. The company, which produces ethanol for blending with unleaded petrol, said while the blending threshold had been reduced from E15 to E10 due to sugarcane shortages caused by flooding, it was working on measures to build reserve stocks that could last for up to 2 months. The Zimbabwe Energy Regulatory Authority announced mandatory blending of fuel, ethanol, at the level of 5% ethanol and 95% unleaded petrol on August 15 last year. This followed the issuing of an ethanol production license to Green Fuel on August 5, but fuel prices have not dropped following the mandatory blending. Former Energy Minister Elton Mangoma, who refused to grant Green Fuel a license during his time in cabinet, said the company's licensing soon after the elections was a scandal because it would result in an individual benefiting at the expense of the nation. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
You are listening to Studio 7 from the Voice of America in Washington.
We are broadcasting on 909 medium wave and on the 4930, 5940 and 15455 shortwave frequencies.
Zimbabwe officially commemorated International Women's Day yesterday with President Robert Mugabe describing as an epidemic the growing problem of gender-based violence in the country. The president was the guest speaker at the commemorations. Responding to questions from women activists and Women's Affairs Minister Opam Chinguri on the need for government to tighten the law and impose stiffer sentences to curb the abuse of women and children in the country, Mr. Mugabe said even the statute books alone were not enough. He called for a nationwide campaign targeting communities at the grassroots level. For perspective, we turned to Padare Enkundleni Chairman Joanna Gokova and Harare West lawmaker Jesse Majomi. Gokova applauds Mr. Mugabe's stance for a nationwide campaign against gender-based violence.
I think that it takes a lot of courage for a man in any position to admit that we are having serious problems in the country regarding gender-based violence. So we hope that more men will be convinced that there is a problem and that men have a role to play in ending gender-based violence in our country.
Honorable Majome, President Mugabe goes as far as calling the problems of gender-based violence as a real epidemic. Are we as a country doing enough in terms of trying to address these issues?
Definitely not. Look, while it's encouraging that the head of state has also lent his voice to ending this particular scourge, I'm really disappointed personally by the government that he leads, that it has failed to just act. We need more action than talk. The government has failed to implement its very own national strategy on gender-based violence that it devised and adopted in 2012 and launched in 2012 at the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence of 2012. It's a national strategy for 2012 to 2015. And today is the 27th of March, 2014. And up to now, there isn't any action plan to actually breathe life into that strategy.
Can you just explain in brief what this strategy aims to do in terms of dealing with gender-based violence in the country?
This strategy is more or less like a local modification of the SADC Protocol on Gender and Development's Article 20 target of reducing gender-based violence by 50% by 2015. But the Zimbabwean government looked at trends of reduction of gender-based violence and found that between 2005 and 2010, its tracked gender-based violence reduced only by 6%. So it decided to set what it can call maybe a more realistic target. And instead of going all the way of 50% of the SADC protocol, it set 20% for itself. So this protocol has four key result areas: the prevention of violence, the provision of services to survivors of gender-based violence. The third one is research, documentation, and monitoring and evaluation of gender-based violence and all these phenomena. And then its fourth is coordination of all these efforts. But up to now, you know, government is just not getting it. They haven't really done, rolled up their sleeves and put out an action rollout plan of the strategy.
Coming to you, Mr. Gokova, we heard Mr. Mugabe yesterday saying that, yes, the government can look at tightening laws to make sure that women and girls are protected from perpetrators of violence. And he is also calling for this national campaign as Padari. What would you want to see being done?
We already have a host of laws that are in place that are seeking to protect the rights and dignity of women. But I think where we are a bit challenged is in ensuring that there is a mass popular awareness campaign on the ground, in the villages, in the locations, for people to understand that we need to work together to end gender-based violence. It must not only involve government, but I think government has an obligation to involve other stakeholders in planning stages, in the implementation of this proposed action plan. Also, the question of resources is another challenge that government must address. We don't want to end up with a lot of statements being made by politicians, but on the ground, resources are not available or they're even denied. And also, it's important to have good laws, but also we should be able to ensure that there is a popular campaign on the ground, and that popular campaign does not exist at the moment. To increase awareness, it does not exist on the ground, and that needs to be worked on.
Can you just explain to us, Honorable Majomi, in terms of your motion now that it is in Parliament, what is the next step for it? When the motion is adopted, are you going to push so that, you know, some of the things that you have debated incorporated into the country's laws? What is the next step?
Okay. My motion seeks to do four things. One, it's to raise the penalties for gender-based violence, specifically that they be a mandatory minimum sentences for rape, that it be 30 years and above for one count of rape, and appropriate sentences higher and sentences with a minimum threshold for all other forms of gender-based violence. So if the Parliament does pass my motion, which I pray that it does, it will require the Minister of Justice, together with the Minister of Women Affairs, even possibly the Minister of Child Welfare, to then craft bills that will amend the Criminal Codification and Law Reform Act, and even the Magistrates Court Act, in order to raise those sentences. Then secondly, my motion seeks to compel the government to continually and sufficiently equip all police stations with rape investigation kits. And thirdly, for the government to immediately provide adequate forensic rape investigation and forensic investigation facilities. For now, it's a scandal that there's no DNA testing in government forensic labs in Zimbabwe, absolutely none. So that's what I expect, that there be reforms in terms of the law and in terms of practice and policy.
Harare West lawmaker Jesse Majome. You also heard the views of Badare Ekuntleni chairman Jonah Gokova. He was in Gwanda.
The number of Zimbabweans dying from AIDS-related illnesses per year has significantly dropped from a high of 170,000 in 2003 down to 60,000 last year, according to a preliminary report of the 2013 HIV estimates presented to non-governmental organizations involved in the fight against HIV. According to the state-controlled Herald newspaper, the Health Ministry Strategic Information Coordinator for the AIDS and TB Unit, Dr. Mutsa Mangara, who told the workshop in Harare, the number of people getting infected with HIV continues to drop. In 2013, it dropped from 1.18% to 1.05% in 2013. Obed Banda, who lives with HIV and is also an HIV/AIDS activist, tells Studio 7 there's also been a significant improvement in the number of people accessing free ARVs.
Well, personally, I think actually the figures, they are really going down, because people are now accessing those drugs. People are no longer fear HIV. They now have information, the correct information about HIV and AIDS, and they know how to take them. So that's why the number of the deaths is now declining, because a lot of people are in treatment. It is unlike in the previous times. ARVs were not all that easily accessible. People didn't have much information about HIV. Now people, they are now open about HIV and AIDS issues. Information has gone to the people. People, they open up about HIV. They no longer fear HIV. So I think that is another reason that is contributing to that. People are aware, people are now free, they are getting information is accessible everywhere.
In the past, we have heard that there are long lines of people waiting to get ARVs. What is the situation now? Are they easily accessible?
There are no longer long queues in the clinics, in the hospitals. At least they have changed.
HIV/AIDS activist Obed Banda speaking with Studio 7 from Bulawayo.
At the office of the United States Congresswoman Karen Bass today hosted its monthly policy breakfast meeting targeting the importance of youth in leadership in Africa, with a panel discussion with a number of young African leaders. The panel discussion, held in Washington, D.C. and moderated by VOA's Shaka Sali, focused on African youth currently and formerly involved in leadership programs, including President Barack Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. Reporter Tatenda Gumbo attended and spoke to Congresswoman Bass.
One of the things that I look forward to doing is exposing these young leaders, who I know will be traveling around the United States, to meet their peers here, because there's many youth organizations throughout the United States that are doing very, very similar work to them.
You did talk about that in your closing remarks. What do you think the importance is of that, things like social media kind of bridging the gap?
I feel when they go around the country, if they are introduced to youth organizations in the United States, they will be able to maintain the connection through social media. But first, they have to know that their peers exist. And I think it is energizing and inspiring for people to know that there's folks all around the world doing the same thing they're doing.
A lot of the talk was about the gender disparity. Mm-hmm. How do you hope that can be curbed?
Well, I think it's critical that we have a better gender balance in the delegation than is reflected today. But we are dealing with gender issues around the world. I mean, it's one of the issues for the U.S. Congress, frankly. Only 17% of the House of Representatives are women. In many African countries, they have a quota, and it is a required to have 40% women. So once again, I think that there's many things that we can learn from each other.
For 2014, 1% of the applicants, which I think was about 500 participants, will be coming here. But it's 1%, which shows that there's an increased interest in the YALI program. How, if any of you, do you hope to engage more so that there can be more people who can come participate in YALI?
Well, the program is a program of the State Department. And frankly, part of them coming and my interest is learning more about the program. So I would love to see there be more young people that are able to come.
Mm-hmm. And any last remarks?
Well, I mean, I think the important thing for the young people to know is that the older generation, myself included, is very committed to their development and their success. And, you know, you're talking about our future. And so it's critically important that we are there to support, provide the resources, and do whatever we need to make sure that they can develop and take power in their various countries.
And that was United States Congresswoman Karen Bass speaking with reporter Tatenda Gumbo.
Now remember to stay tuned for Studio 7's Live Talk at 8:30 p.m. when our hosts will discuss with experts and you, the listeners, about women and gender-based violence.
Call us what